Welcome to Students Incorporated, a podcast exploring the topics of business, education, technology, and design. I'm your host, Mr. Jason. Join me weekly as my team and I produce content that's informative, positive, fun, and uplifting. Episodes include student conversations, interviews with thought leaders, and inspirational stories with an international flavor. This podcast is created and produced with the help of students from the International Community School of Bangkok. Hello and welcome back to Students Incorporated. We're glad you're here and thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Mr. Jason. For our first segment, we're joined by co-hosts Premi and Rebecca, and we have the privilege of talking with Ms. Sam Fox of HarperCollins Publishers out of New York City. We'll get to hear a little bit about her career journey into branding and marketing and find out some of the ins and outs of what her job is like at a large publishing company. Then for segment two, we'll continue with part three of our story, The Secrets of El Dorado. So stick around as we have an exciting and jam-packed episode. But before we jump into our discussion with Sam, let's hear our quote of the day and get some headline news.
Hey everyone, I'm Rebecca, and your quote of the day comes from David Brabham. He said, "Marketing is telling the world you are a rock star. Publishing is showing the world you can play." This quote highlights the contrast between marketing and publishing. Marketing is about claiming excellence, like declaring you are a rock star, while publishing is the act of proving it, like demonstrating you actually do have musical talent by performing. This emphasizes that genuine credibility and reputation come from showing actual skills and value most just from promoting or talking about it. And that's our quote of the day. Now onto some headline news.
Thank you, Rebecca. And now here's some headline marketing news from around the world. With 2023 having significant inflation, beverage and food company SIE's chief marketing officer has recently talked about the importance of brand trust. For context, Asahi had to raise prices by 15 to 20% to keep the company stable during the rapid inflation. However, the price increase comes with drawbacks in demand. As AP Econ students would know, customers are less willing to buy products if the price increases. With the power of marketing, Asahi's strong brand image in the beverage industry allowed it to have a strong customer retention rate even with the added costs. The CMO, Grant McKenzie, stated that the stronger your brand, the better your ability to take price. In addition to mentioning the company's marketing efficiency, McKenzie has also mentioned the importance of effective marketing, which was highlighted in this specific scenario due to how well the company's marketing strategy contributed to its customer retention. And moving on, a fast food chain, McDonald's, their reps recently spoke at the Market Research Society's annual conference on March 12th. According to McDonald's, they had become trusted by 3/5 of the UK public and had set out to capture the remaining 2/5 through the use of comedy and creativity by adding elements of humor in their new campaign called Keep Up With The Times. In this campaign, they depicted the negative views on McDonald's as outdated and misinformed when it came to the quality of their food, something that McDonald's say they place a heavy emphasis on. This marketing decision was an attempt to penetrate further into a customer-based displays, the methods that companies use to modernize themselves and gain more customers. And finally, moving on to our last news piece, in their latest software update, Google has recently updated their search engine core this month, which will reduce the damage done by the harmful uses of AI technology that skew search results and take over expired domains that are then converted into hubs for links, which are both considered spam. Google's core update has also added host sites that rely on other sites to market their content to their list of targets. The update rolls out next month and will likely help with interruptions and inconveniences caused by the new surges in technology and digital marketing that are a source of many internet users' annoyances and would hopefully remove the massive amounts of spam advertising. And that ends our headline news.
We are back for our first segment of this episode. We have the privilege of talking with Ms. Sam Fox of HarperCollins Publishers all the way over in New York City. Premi will kick off this segment with our first question.
Hello, and thank you so much for coming on the show. Could you please introduce yourself and give us a brief overview of what you do?
Hi, thank you for having me. My name is Sam Fox. I am the Director of Content Creation and Marketing Strategy for HarperCollins Publishers. Before coming to Harper, I was the marketing brand lead at Teen Vogue, and the majority of my role is managing a team of digital marketing managers, social media managers, video producers, and other types of marketers to create content about our wonderful books and share it across all of our platforms so that we can connect the fans of our books, connect with the fans of the books that we publish.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Can you share a little bit about your journey from university to where you are now and what inspired you?
Yeah, of course. So I was actually a dance major in university. I was training to be a professional dancer, so clearly very different from what I'm doing now. But I did, I had an English double major, and I always loved reading and writing. And I was an editor for a college newspaper. So by the time I was ready to start thinking about graduating, I decided that despite all of my training, I was no longer interested in pursuing a career in dance. And I started looking into journalism instead. And so I ended up doing this fellowship for the end of my senior year at AOL. And in that role, you know, I learned how to discover and write breaking news, manage social media channels, interview celebrities for, you know, special features, all that kind of stuff. And I ended up going there full time when I graduated and learning so much from that. And then I received a call from Teen Vogue about 6 months later asking me to interview for a position that they were looking to fill. And the catch was that rather than it being an editorial position, it was a marketing position on the social media marketing team. And so at first I wasn't sure I wanted to switch to a marketing role, but I took the interview, and when they told me all of the amazing things that Teen Vogue was planning to publish and these big moments that they wanted to establish and all these stories that I wish I had had when I was a teenager, I decided that I wanted to be part of this regardless of what the role was. And that's how I found myself in marketing. But, you know, in the 6 years that I spent at Teen Vogue, I fell in love with marketing. And I became, you know, just really passionate about the brand's mission and figuring out how I could use the marketing skills I was learning to, you know, help young people understand, you know, how they can make an impact on the areas that they care about and how they can feel seen and heard. So then I decided to take those marketing skills and bring them over to the publishing industry because I loved books more than anything in the world and was curious about what it was like to work in publishing. So I switched over to that industry where I'm now handling a lot of our marketing. And really just what I realized through all of this is that at the end of the day, what inspires me and the reason I do it is because I'm passionate about helping these young people and working on brands that focus on making young people feel seen and heard.
That is so inspiring. I love that so, so much. And that's crazy too, from like a dance major and then like following all the places to where you are now. We were wondering if you could describe your experiences from past work and how that has helped you in your current position.
Yeah, definitely. I think no matter what you're doing, even if it's something that's a completely different industry or role, you can take things that you've learned previously and bring them into the next. So for me, working at AOL taught me how to run social media platforms for a brand and what the reporting and analytics side of all of it looks like. I took that with me to Teen Vogue, and then, you know, there I was able to amp up our social media marketing strategy and, you know, partner with influencers on various campaigns. I learned a lot about influencers when I was at AOL. And then working at Teen Vogue, I learned how to brainstorm, propose, and execute all these different marketing campaigns and brand partnerships and how to be a team leader. And most importantly, I think at Teen Vogue, I learned that marketing at its core is another form of storytelling and that the most successful marketers are the ones who care about the brand story and want to share it with the world. So I took that with me to my current position and try to inspire my team to, you know, do everything through the lens of storytelling. I think the sales numbers matter, but at the end of the day, sales isn't just about getting people to click on an ad and purchase your product. You know, when an audience engages and interacts with your brand, they're more likely to turn to you when they're looking to buy products, which in my case is books. So that's just a little kind of spiel on how, you know, all of it has tied together and how, even though it seemingly doesn't make sense, it does work when you put it in that perspective.
It does. And I love how you say like a lot of marketing is storytelling, because I think that's what a lot of what we learn to hear in marketing class. It is storytelling. And then storytelling to sell books, which is another story, right?
What does your job description look like? What's an average work week look like for you?
Every week looks very different. And, you know, I purposely try to find roles where that's the case because I like to get my hands, you know, dirty in different areas and really kind of get involved in different things on a day to day. So on any given week, I might participate in brainstorms with the social media and video teams to come up with really fun concepts that show off a certain book that we're trying to market to our readers. I might spend time in the studio helping to film that content. Maybe I'm getting on calls with authors to discuss marketing plans for their upcoming books and how we'll be working together, meeting with authors at various events or in the office to take videos of them hyping up their books, giving presentations to company leaders to share what our numbers are looking like and how we're strategizing for upcoming books we plan to market, working with retail partners and influencers, you know, campaigns that we're doing with them or planning big brand events.
That sounds really busy, but so cool. I still cannot get over how you can see, like, meet so many authors.
I don't do all of those things at the same time on the same day, so it is spread out.
Moving on, if you could walk us through the process of developing a marketing campaign for a new book.
Yes, definitely. So when you're developing a marketing campaign for a new book, it's all about determining what your main goals are for that book and then figuring out the right ways to reach those goals. So for example, if we're working with a brand new author who's never published a book before, we would want to focus on, you know, A, getting people to buy the book, and B, introducing the author to, you know, book readers everywhere. So therefore, our campaign might include retailer partnerships and general advertisements that drive direct sales, adding the book to lists on our website where it makes sense, and also working with the author by bringing them into our office and taking a video of them introducing themselves and sharing some fun facts that readers should know about them. But if we're working with a best-selling author who's publishing their 20th book, you know, we might focus more on sort of their fandoms and reaching the readers who already know and love this author, which means we'd probably lean more into like influencer posts on TikTok, sending early copies of the books to mega fans, sending the author on a tour around the country to meet with fans in their towns and things like that. So it's really kind of case by case depending on for what the book is and who the author is.
Yeah, that makes sense. For like different authors, the process would look a little different, like personalized to that book and that author, right? And then author tours, book tours around. Oh, that's crazy. I love that though. That must be so fun. And do you get to go on these tours as well?
Normally I don't, but I did get really lucky. In 2022, I was able to go on a week-long tour with six of our best-selling authors all around the country. They're the authors of the Whiteout and Blackout series. It was very, very cool.
I remember asking you. It was like, I love this book. Have you heard of it? And you're like, have I heard of it? I've gone on tour with them.
And you were like, I just read this book called Whiteout. And I was like, I was just on tour for a book called Whiteout.
And I was like, no, actually. And then this happens all the time. But book tour is so cool.
In what ways does the publisher collaborate with the author, especially in the marketing of the book?
So for this, you know, that's a great question. It really depends on who the author is and what book they're publishing. You know, we always start a marketing campaign for a new book by getting on a call with the author, walking them through our plans so that they're looped in on everything that we're doing and they can provide suggestions, they can ask questions. We might also ask the author to get involved by filming some content with us or attending events depending on what's needed. So sometimes, you know, we get on the call and that's really all we're going to see of the author for the majority of the campaign. And sometimes we get on the call and that's just the start of a relationship where we'll be seeing them very often. And that really just depends on sort of what the main goals are for their marketing campaign and how involved we need them to be.
That's really insightful. And like you said again, right, like each book or each author, the process would look a little different. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But how would you measure success when you're running a marketing campaign? Are there certain metrics that you collect?
Yeah, so this is a really great question because I think it reaffirms why it's so important to start every marketing campaign by establishing what our goals are for that campaign. So if a goal was to generate as many book sales as possible, then we would measure success by looking at sales growth during the time frame of that campaign. if the goal was to generate buzz and excitement for an upcoming title, and you weren't as concerned about sales in that sort of pre-order phase, then we'll measure success by looking at the engagement metrics of the content that we produce to see how many people interacted with the content. So success can look different for different campaigns. And it's always important to be clear about what success metrics you're prioritizing before you dive into the work of the campaign.
Could you share about any campaign that went really well and maybe some that did not, and why?
I can. I won't share the names of the books or authors so as not to embarrass anyone or share any information that they might not want me to, but I can be kind of vague about it and say that we worked on a campaign where we wanted to generate excitement for the book. It was the final book in a really big series, and we decided to create a book trailer that showed a bunch of the elements from the book. So we had like the castle and the dragon breathing fire and all these really cool things that made it look more like a movie trailer than a book trailer. And we set that video up to play on billboards all over New York City in addition to our social media channels. So it was a really cool moment for me, like being in the subway and seeing the video that my team produced, like playing on a billboard. And, you know, then we had the author come into the office to make TikTok videos in which we all begged her to tell us how the series ends. That's like the concept of the video that we do. She obviously never actually tells us, but the video went super viral, which was awesome to see that, you know, we clearly found something that fans were excited about. And then that same day, we took the author to a bookstore where hundreds of fans were waiting to ask her questions and take photos with her. So all together, it was really kind of a 360 campaign that did really well. When it comes to campaigns that don't perform well, I think the biggest mistake is trying to do something that worked for another book or author that was extremely different from the book and author that we're working with now. So for example, you know, if one author's video introducing all of their book characters did really well for them, that doesn't mean it'll do well for another author who saw that video and wants to try something similar. So maybe the plot doesn't lend itself to that concept. Maybe the author isn't as comfortable on camera. Maybe the genre of the book reaches an audience that isn't as interested in that type of video. So really it's our job to recognize that no two books are the same and no two authors are the same. And we have to really kind of cater to the strength of the books and the author.
Yeah, that makes sense. For different books, yeah. And even though like an author might see like something similar, but it might not work depending on the plot, because every story, every book is so different. And like so unique to itself and its elements too. But talking about like campaigns that did went well, that's crazy. Seeing like you said, like on the billboard, that is absolutely crazy. And honestly, that is the coolest idea. Because really, some big series and their plot twists, authors are just too good at hiding little details, and then they never tell.
And like those are some fun things about marketing too. And like, you know, we all see billboards. Like you go to New York City, you go to Times Square, you see all these billboards and you're like, how did they get there?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like, who makes that happen? And then you realize that all you really have to do is Google it and you might be the person who makes that happen, you know? And that's what's really fun about marketing, is taking those things into your own hands and kind of being the person who just gets that stuff done, you know?
Yeah. Okay, moving forward. What trends and or challenges do you foresee within the field of marketing or the publishing industry?
Great question. I'd say within the publishing industry, the big thing that we're seeing a lot of celebrity book clubs emerging. So I'm really curious to see how that impacts the industry at large. You know, Reese Witherspoon has Reese's Book Club, which has been around for a while now, and it has had a really significant impact in what readers were buying from their local bookstores. We're also seeing more online and social media purchases. I think that's something across all of marketing, not just in publishing, as well as the rise of influencers on social media. You know, these are social media creators who have established these big followings, who, you know, have kind of created these communities online who listen to them and take their advice and take their product recommendations. So a huge thing in marketing right now is working with these people to kind of more authentically share your products with their audiences. And I don't see that going away anytime soon. And then, you know, this isn't a new trend in books, but another thing we're seeing a lot is books getting turned into movies or TV shows. I don't know if any of you all saw like the Semi Turn Pretty, which is a huge series, and, you know, the Kissing Booth, and To All the Boys I Loved Before, and, you know, all of those. And so, you know, that always ends up generating a ton of sales for the book.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think I love that, like, authenticity, right? You said is, like, coming up more and it's not going away. So I love that. And people are definitely buying. Like, if I go to, like, Book Talk or, like Instagram, like, there is, like, its own separate, like, sector just for books. And then, like, book reviews and then, like, talking about books. And so I can definitely see, like, so many people buying books from those platforms or those venues a lot more.
And our final question is, what advice would you give to a person who is thinking about getting into the marketing field or the publishing industry?
So it's actually funny that you just mentioned Book Talk, because I think my biggest piece of advice is to get on Book Talk. There's such a rise in both influencer marketing and social media marketing. So TikTok and Instagram in general, but especially BookTok and Bookstagram, which are kind of these niche spaces that book nerds have carved out for ourselves, are really the spaces that publishers are paying attention to. So if you use those platforms for fun in your everyday life and you understand how they work and what makes someone successful on the platforms, you'll already be an asset to the publishing industry when you go to apply for your first job, just by living it and experiencing it and understanding the consumer. And I think, you know, when it comes to marketing, it's all about empathy. It's all about putting yourself in the shoes of whoever you're marketing to and saying, you know, what would encourage me to buy this product or follow this account? And so, you know, when you're in the same social spaces that you know your audience is in, that enables you to kind of be empathetic with them and figure out some cool ideas that, you know, other people who aren't in those spaces might not be thinking about.
That's super powerful. Thank you so much again for joining us. We're so honored for you to be here. And you've taught us so many things. It's been super insightful and so powerful and inspiring to see what you've done and the advice that you give. So thank you so much.
Of course, thank you.
And that ends segment one of this episode. A big thanks to Sam for joining us virtually from New York for this interview. Stick around as we continue with part three of our story for segment two right after this short PSA.
One, two, three, four.
Hi, this is Sam Fox. I work in marketing at HarperCollins Publishers, and I am a guest on the Students Incorporated podcast this week. Make sure to check out some new books that have recently come out or are coming out soon. We've got Infinity Kings by Adam Silvera, Under This Red Rock by Mindy McGinnis, and The Lilies by Quinn Diacon-Furtado.
We are back for our second segment, and we will continue with part three of our story titled The Map. But first, Premi will give us a quick recap from our last episode.
In the last episode, Lily, Ava, and Sierra head to the sciences department at the college, hoping to get to the bottom of Chen's mysterious text. As it turns out, they meet Professor Charpton from the sciences department, and he lets them know that Chen is an assistant to one of the professors in the history department. When they arrived, they met none other than Professor Hawthorne from the history department, who Chen had been a lab assistant for. Professor Hawthorne had said that Chen has not been answering his calls either, and says that that is very unlike him. He then finds an old piece of paper with ancient Chinese characters. He realizes later they match the characters from a document in the filing cabinet from a long, long time ago. These are the two things on his mind as he makes his way to Ethan's cafe, that and his favorite sandwich. And that's where we left off.
Thank you, Premi. And without further ado, let's get back into our story where we join Ava, Lily, Sierra, Ethan, and the professor.
Sierra, Ava, and Lily are back in the cafe. Sierra has clocked back in and is busy again behind the counter taking customer orders, cleaning tables, and doing dishes. She catches Ethan out of the corner of her eye, waving her over to his laptop that's sitting on one of the counters behind the main bar area.
Hey, check this out, Ethan tells Sierra as he points to his laptop screen and shows her a map of the squiggly lines on it. Oh, "Can I have that thing back that I gave you before you left for your lunch break?" he asked. He then goes on and thanks her for testing out his newest tech device, a small tracker that looks like a paperclip. This small device is a medium-power, medium-range transmitter that transmits a simple ping every 30 seconds. Ethan kept the power and range just under the US regulations so that the device would not have to be licensed. Basically, Ethan wants to sell the device to his old company in the hopes that the stock price will increase, which in turn will increase his personal nest egg. Plus, it's just a really cool device.
Sierra looks intrigued and a little skeptical as she says, "Wow, that's pretty cool. So you can basically track anywhere that device goes within a certain range?"
Ethan goes on, "Yeah, and that other cool thing about it is that its range is quite large in comparison to all the other products on the market. It's small and powerful. I've made several prototypes and I'm just now testing them with the software I wrote. The mapping software I created then shows the location of that device in real time. So that's what you are looking at, where you went the last hour and a half during your lunch break. It looks like you went to the college campus and spent some time in two different buildings."
Sierra is standing there with a straight face. She's not really wanting to hear all the technical details about the device, nor is she super thrilled that she was unknowingly testing a tracking device for one of Ethan's side projects. Don't get her wrong. She likes it and thinks it's cool, but she's also thinking about all the other tasks she has to finish during her shift before she can clock out and go home.
Meanwhile, Ava and Lily are back sitting together again in the cafe. Since most of the double tables are occupied already, they're sitting up at the bar counter opposite of where Ethan and Sierra are having their conversation behind the bar. Lily is asking Ava a lot of questions about some of Ava's past articles she's written for the Bee.
Professor Hawthorne enters the cafe and heads right to the counter to place his order. "I'll take my usual, thank you," as he tells one of the other cafe employees who's working the register. He notices an open seat at the bar counter and goes to sit down. Right then, he realizes it's next to Ava and Lily. "Oh, we meet again," he says, as the two girls turn around to see who the person is that's going to sit next to them. "Do you mind if I sit here?" he asks. "I usually sit up at the bar when I come in for lunch since I'm typically in a hurry and I'm by myself."
"No problem," Lily replied.
Ava notices right away that Professor Hawthorne had brought his briefcase and had it sitting up on the counter where he got situated. She watched as he struggled to find a place to set the briefcase down.
Professor Hawthorne opened up the briefcase and pulled out the old manila folder and a folded up piece of paper and set them on the counter in front of himself. He then shut the briefcase and set it down on the floor next to his bar stool. Since bar stools stand higher than regular table chairs, he had an awkward time sitting back up straight after setting the briefcase down on the floor.
Ava watched all this happening and then saw Professor Hawthorne accidentally knock the manila folder off the counter as he was sitting back up. The folder and the old manuscript that was inside fell on the opposite side of the counter behind the bar.
Professor Hawthorne said under his breath, but loud enough so Lily and Ava could hear him, "Oh man, well look at that. I guess you can't take me anywhere."
Lily quickly offered to help pick up the papers that had fallen out of the folder, but felt a little timid since they had fallen behind the bar.
Ava quickly scanned the cafe looking for a staff member, of which they were all busy doing something else in another part of the shop. Ethan had gone to the back room to take a phone call a minute earlier, and Sierra was busy taking several customer orders up at the cash register. Ava quickly reacted and said, "I'll grab them for you since Sierra won't have a problem with me sneaking behind the counter for a second." Ava went around the back of the bar counter and started picking up all the papers that had fallen. She noticed that all the papers looked quite old and worn. She thought to herself, "This looks interesting. I wonder what Professor Hawthorne is up to." After she had gathered all the papers off the floor, she noticed several paper clips sitting on the counter next to the laptop. She picked up one of the paper clips and attached all the pages together, and then walked around the counter and handed the stack of paper to Professor Hawthorne. "There you go," she says.
"Ah, thank you so much," Professor Hawthorne tells Ava. As he's waiting for his lunch, he asks Ava and Lily, "How do you all know each other?"
Ava responds first. "Sierra and I grew up together in Coloma, but we went to different colleges. I'm back here visiting right now for work. The Bee has me doing a series of articles on the Gold Rush Festival this summer."
"Oh, I see," says Professor Hawthorne.
Lily chimes in and says, "I come to Ethan's a lot, especially during the school year, to study and hang out with my friends. Sierra was always so kind in allowing us to sit at the big table and study. Of course, we needed to buy drinks or food. Oh, by the way, I really enjoyed taking forensic archaeology from you last year. It was super helpful to learn about how archaeology can assist criminal investigations.
Professor Hawthorne responds to Lily, "Ah, thank you. That's actually one of my favorite classes to teach because it's practical, more skills-based, and less academic than most classes that I teach." Professor Hawthorne goes on, "Coloma is a small town and it's a close-knit community. Everybody knows everybody and you gotta be okay with everybody knowing your business."
"For sure," Ava replies. "That's one of the reasons I wanted to go to university away from home, actually." Well, that and Cal State has a great journalism program.
By this time, Sierra was done with some of the rush orders, grabbed Professor Hawthorne's order and walked back over to where they were all sitting up at the bar. She handed Professor Hawthorne his sandwich and iced tea and interrupted and said, "So, have you found out what happened to this guy Chen yet?"
Professor Hawthorne was just about to take a big bite out of his sandwich when he heard Sierra's question. He put the sandwich back down on the plate and pointed to the manuscript papers and the note sitting next to his plate on the counter. He said, "No, but I did bring a note Chen left me last week and an old manuscript to study over lunch. There may be an interesting connection between the two."
Vivi was looking over toward Professor Hawthorne as he opened the folded piece of paper which had what looked like some sort of formula, along with several Chinese characters scribbled on it. Lily blurts out, "Those are Chinese characters. Did Chen write these?" As Professor Hawthorne begins answering her questions, she noticed that the characters are not the typical and modern Chinese characters she is used to seeing.
Professor Hawthorne continues, "Chen gave me this note as he was leaving work on Friday and didn't say much about it. He just said that he wanted me to have a copy of something that he was working on and if I could just hold it for him for the time being. I didn't think much about the note at the time. I glanced at it briefly, noticed there was some weird formula written along with some series of Chinese characters. I tried my new image-to-language translation app to my phone to see if I could read the characters, but no luck. Translation app did not recognize the characters, so I folded it up and put it in a safe place in case Chen came back for it sometime."
Ava, who was sitting on the stool between Professor Hawthorne and Lily, asked Professor Hawthorne if she could take a photo of it and send it to one of her colleagues at the Bee, who's an amazing researcher. "I'll just send a photo of two of the three of these characters, but not all of them. And I'll see if my buddy Ted can do his magic for us. He owes me a favor anyway," Ava says. She quickly snaps a photo of the several Chinese characters and sends Ted the photos along with a short message that reads, "What type of Chinese characters are these? ?" "You know you owe me," followed by three smiley face emojis.
As Ava is taking photos and sending Ted the text, Professor Hawthorne takes another bite of his sandwich, puts it down on the plate, and then starts thumbing through the manuscript papers that are paper-clipped together. The manuscript is about 120 pages in length, makes some interesting claims about the gold from this area, and also includes detailed illustrations of different locations surrounding Sutter's Mill, the surrounding mountains, and some back horse trails.
Sierra glances over towards their direction and notices they are all talking and looking very serious. She decides to pause for a moment on her way out to the cafe sitting area to clean up a few tables. As she walks up to where the three are sitting, she asks lightheartedly, "Did you solve the mystery yet?"
Ava pipes up, "Nope, not yet."
"I'm actually trying to figure out this weird clue from Chen's note. These Chinese characters I'm not familiar with," Lee says.
Interesting, Sierra replies. She then says, "Chen has nice handwriting, though."
Right at that moment, and as Professor Hawthorne started taking another bite of his sandwich, he pauses as he finds what he's looking for on the manuscript. There, on page 87, are some of the same Chinese characters written on the margins. Some of the characters look similar to the characters in Chen's note. Professor Hawthorne thinks to himself, there's no way this can be a coincidence.
Ava, who's sitting right next to Professor Hawthorne, looks down at the manuscript and blurts out and asks, "Whoa, are those the same characters that are on Chen's note?"
"Yes, it appears that way, and I have a hard time believing that this is just a coincidence," replied Professor Hawthorne.
Lily and Sierra are also looking over at page 87 of the manuscript that's open on the counter. Lily asks, "What's page 87 about?"
Sierra repeats the question, "Yeah, what's on page 87?
At that moment, Ethan comes out of the back room and notices the three girls and Professor Hawthorne all staring down at something. He stops and says, "Looks like a serious meeting here. Is your sandwich okay, Professor?"
"Yeah, Ethan is great, as usual. Thank you."
Just then, Ava's phone dings with a message from Ted. She says, "Hey guys, Ted just texted me back and he thinks those characters look like they might be part of an old code, but an old code that isn't used anymore. His text also said that he found a really old article in the Bee's internal online archives that references an old Chinese telegraphic code book that was used in the late 1800s for the purpose of encoding and translating Chinese characters to Morse code used for a telegraph machine."
No sooner did Ava get those words out, Professor Hawthorne stood up and said, "Ted's exactly right. This manuscript, even though it may have some inaccuracies, does contain plenty of other helpful information about this place, including that many of the workers who helped complete the railroad line through this country after the gold rush were immigrants from mainland China." Professor Hawthorne turns to another page in the manuscript, which describes the difficulty many of the railroad workers had being so far from home, not knowing the local language, no way to communicate with other family members, and so forth. He goes on, "If I remember correctly, the Orient in the East did not get access to use the telegraph until the 1870s, at which time the telegraph cables were finally laid, which then connected China to Russia, Europe, and North America."
Meanwhile, and during this entire conversation, Ethan has his back turned to the group and is tapping on his keyboard, almost appearing as if he wasn't even listening. However, he picks up his laptop and turns around towards the group. As Ethan points to his laptop screen, he says, "Look what I found online. Here's the entire Chinese telegraphic code book from the late 1800s. Looks like it's obsolete. Or at least, that's what Wikipedia says now. Well, maybe you could at least translate those characters now so Sierra can get back to work," he says with a half grin.
The team translates the Chinese characters from Chen's note first. It's a grouping of two sets of numbers alongside two English letters. N, 38. 51, 21, and W, 120, 26, 55. "I know exactly what these are," said Professor Hawthorne to the group. "These are coordinates, latitude and longitude, degrees, minutes, and seconds." "Ethan, can you look up these and see where this is?" asked Professor Hawthorne.
Ethan quickly types in the coordinates online. The coordinates point to a place named Silver Creek by Junction Reservoir off the old El Dorado National Forest Road, Ethan replies. It's southwest of the larger Union Valley Reservoir. Ethan looks up at the others for a half smile. So, is this some sort of secret message then?
Lee responds, "So, what do we do now?"
"What about the characters from the manuscript? Could you look those up as well?" Ava asks Ethan.
Ethan translates the characters from the manuscript. N38, 55, 28, and W120, 24, 12. He enters in the two sets of coordinates and then says, "The other set of characters translates the coordinates as well. Those coordinates point to Rob's Peak, a 6,600-foot mountain just north of the Union Valley Reservoir."
Professor Hawthorne pulls out his phone again and tries to call Chen. He's wondering to himself if there is some connection between what the author of the manuscript is communicating so many years ago and now to what Chen is trying to communicate or found.
Ava is taking notes as she secretly hopes this is something bigger than just a missing person case. Her editor at the Bee would love it and maybe even give her a promotion. She's cautious not to get ahead of herself though. By the way, we aren't even sure if this even is a missing person case, since Chen hasn't technically been missing for 24 hours yet.
Sierra is studying the code table that Ethan still has open on his laptop screen, wondering how and why Chen decided to use a coded message, sort of like making a map, but without using the typical topographical symbols.
And that ends part 3 of our story. Thank you for listening. Tune in next episode as we continue with part 4 titled Histories and Legends. As we end this episode, we want to again give a big thanks to Ms. Sam Fox of HarperCollins out of New York for joining us in segment 1 and for sharing with us her journey into branding and marketing and for also giving us some great advice along the way. As always, this podcast would not be possible without the hard work and support of our international student production team.
All music and sound effects are courtesy of Pixabay.com, a vibrant community of creatives sharing copyright-free images, videos, and music.
And we are signing off until next time. We are Students Incorporated, because your voice matters.